This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, February 13th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, poetry's Adventurous Valentine. In the history of American poetry, there are very few poets who have broken out into the larger culture and become genuinely popular icons. Robert Frost comes to mind, Allen Ginsberg, maybe. Among women, one thinks of Edna St. Vincent Millay, who became famous as a young bohemian poet in Greenwich Village in the late teens and early 20s. On our website this week, Kate Bullock writes about the achievements and unlikely life of Millay. Kate Bullock is a freelance writer based in New York and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Kate, do you remember the first time that you read Edna St. Vincent Millay and what you thought of her poems?
I do. I remember coming across her in high school, or kind of like late middle school, early high school, around the time I was reading Emily Dickinson. And I loved both of them.
Such different characters,
too. They're very different, but they're both very passionate writers. And they really captured my adolescent heart.
Was she formative in your...
You know, it's funny. At the time, in middle school and high school, I loved reading Edna. Mm-hmm. And then in college, I started writing poetry myself and taking it very seriously. And I didn't take her seriously then. I never read her. She was too popular. I didn't take her seriously as a poet, and I never looked at her.
So what changed between that time in college and now? Because you've written a very positive piece about her. You really obviously like her poems and you like what her life says to you.
Yeah.
What changed?
I find Edna to be a fascinating American figure and a fascinating female figure in America. So what she embodied at that moment in time and what accounted for her popularity was not only her talent as a poet, but also she was pushing the boundaries of how women were allowed to think and talk about love. And by doing that, she gave voice to a whole new range of emotion in a public way that women hadn't been able to do before. So she was massively important to the ways in which women think and talk about themselves.
Yeah, she had a huge cultural impact at the time. And it's kind of hard to see why from our point of view today, but maybe we'll learn a little bit more about that now. You write that it isn't easy to think about Edna St. Vincent Millay's body of work without also thinking about her actual body. And she was not shy about using her body and her famous beauty to her advantage. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I was writing the piece, I was struck by how much Edna looked like the beauty ideal of her time. Mm. So she was small and kind of wraith-like and had these masses of auburn waves, and she would wear them in Edwardian pile on her head. So she looked very romantic and fragile.
Sort of pre-Raphaelite or something.
Yeah, I mean, so a funny thing about her is that she grew up in a tiny little town on the coast of Maine, very poor, not sophisticated or glamorous at all, or, you know, didn't have any contact with sophistication or glamour. But even so, the way she came to public attention was she wrote a poem called Renaissance that was published in an anthology called The Lyric Year in 1912. And when she was corresponding with the editor of the poetry contest, after her submission, she sent him a photograph of herself. And so she was canny. You know, she knew that she was attractive, and she knew that it was a man on the other side of this correspondence that she was having. And she went on to do that a lot when she was starting out as a poet. She would always enclose her portrait with her poems.
That is canny, I guess. Now, let me get you to read one of the poems that you mentioned in your piece. And it's called The Penitent. But before you read it, is there anything that you think might be helpful to know about it so we can kind of wrap our heads around it?
Yeah, so The Penitent was first published in Poetry Magazine in June 1918, and then later collected in her book, A Few Figs from Thistles, which came out in 1922 and helped her win the Pulitzer in 1923. And what I really like about this poem is that it's a great example of her satirical, flippant voice that she was so popular for at the time.
Huh. Okay, go ahead and give it a read. Here's The Penitent by Edna St. Vincent Millay.
I had a little sorrow, born of a little sin. I found a room all damp with gloom, and shut us all within. And little sorrow, weep, said I, and little sin, pray God to die, and I upon the floor will lie and think how bad I've been. Alas for pious planning, it mattered not a whit. As far as gloom went in that room, the lamp might have been lit. My little sorrow would not weep. My little sin would go to sleep. To save my soul, I could not keep my graceless mind on it. So up I got in anger and took a book I had and put a ribbon on my hair to please a passing lad. And one thing there's no getting by, I've been a wicked girl, said I. But if I can't be sorry, why, I might as well be glad.
Well, in the same instance, I'm glad you said it was satire, and I'm glad you caught the tone of it in your reading, because I think a lot of people probably did read it more straight, without as much attitude in it. For example, I had a little sorrow born of a little sin. To me, that suggests a baby. That's the metaphor, right? Mm-hmm. That's a pretty serious problem she's got on her hands, if that's the case. But you're right. She doesn't really feel bad about what happened.
Exactly.
But what do you think the little sin was here?
Probably sex, right?
You know, one would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you think she was absorbed culturally? A poem like this, how do you think it came into the culture and how do you think it was received? Shocking?
You know, she doesn't seem to have shocked, as far as I can tell, so much as... that's what's partly so interesting about the way she was received. She was writing her poems and expressing this attitude at the exact right time. If she had been a little earlier, it would have been shocking. And then a little later, it wouldn't have mattered. You know, plenty of people did it. But she was articulating a growing sentiment exactly as women were articulating it to themselves.
She was right on the cusp of the flapper era.
Exactly. So what she was saying was radical in that it hadn't been said, but it wasn't so radical that it was shocking people into thinking that she wasn't too much for culture. And part of that was because she was using traditional forms to write her poems. And so she was very accessible and readable in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also traveling around a lot and reading her poems in auditoriums, and her physical presence had so much to do with how she was received. Not only that she was appealing to look at, but she just had, from all accounts, so much charisma, you know, a real star power. And so she's this, you know, tiny little pale elfin kind of woman with a ton of presence and a very resonant theatrical voice, too, that she used. And so I think that that whole package made her very easy to swallow.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear another poem. There's one poem that she published in 1922 called Four Sonnets, and we're not going to hear all four of them. I think they stand alone. Is there anything that you want to say about this one before?
Well, I just wanted to say that these sonnets appeared in her book, A Few Figs from Thistles, which came out in 1922.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know what that phrase meant, figs from thistles. Do you?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so I looked it up, and it's from a passage in the New Testament where Matthew is warning against false prophets. So I'll read that. It's Matthew 7:16.
Okay, good.
Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. So figs from thistles, so she's saying, I mean, she's turning it on its head, and she's saying, I'm a bad seed.
Uh-huh. That's a subtle reference.
Yeah. So I'm reading the third sonnet in this series.
And it's about fickleness.
Oh, think not I am faithful to a vow. Faithless am I, save to love's self alone. Were you not lovely, I would leave you now. After the feet of beauty fly my own. Were you not still my hunger's rarest food, and water ever to my wildest thirst, I would desert you. Think not, but I would. And seek another as I sought you first. But you are mobile as the veering air, and all your charms more changeful than the tide. Wherefore, to be inconstant is no care. I have but to continue at your side. So wanton, light, and false, my love, are you. I am most faithless when I most am true.
That's a pretty good sonnet.
Yeah.
That really works all the way through. And it's saying something so unusual for a woman at the time, I think, to be saying.
Yeah. Which, I think even now. Really.
Even now, yeah. Right? Women aren't supposed to harbor thoughts like these.
And in a way, men aren't either. I mean, we all long for and believe in love's permanence.
Mm.
So this kind of inconstancy that she is praising is unusual.
Yeah. In the very beginning of the poem, she's setting herself up as basically opposed to marriage. She says, "Oh, think not I am faithful to a vow." Mm-hmm. She's saying, "I'm not going to take marriage seriously. Faithless I am, save to love's self alone." So the higher value for her is not the person, but love itself. Mm-hmm. "Were you not lovely, I would leave you now." Now, that's funny because she's talking, I don't know if she's talking to a woman or a man. It's not clear in the poem, but basically, "If you're not good looking, I would leave you right now." That's a very bald thing to say, don't you think?
Yes.
And then, "Were you not my hunger's rarest food?" She's saying, "You satisfy me sexually."
Yeah.
"And water ever to my wildest thirst, I would desert you, think not, but I would, and seek another as I sought you first." So that's the problem. She's saying, basically, I'm here for the time that you entertain me sexually.
Well, yeah, it's more than that, though. Mm-hmm. She's saying that she's in it for passion, and that when she's there, she's feeling really passionate for you, and she'll leave the second she doesn't any longer.
That would be a hard person to be around.
Yeah.
But she was very attractive.
Yeah.
And so that's the first eight lines of the sonnet, and then the sonnet turns. And what does she do in that second half? The you becomes more prominent.
Oh, well, she's saying that he's not constant. He's as faithless as she is.
She's like, he's like she is. And we're assuming it's a he, but who knows?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. She was bisexual.
Yeah. "And all your charms more changeful than the tide." Yeah. "Just like me. Wherefore, to be inconstant is no care. I have but to continue at your side." So there's a partnership here.
Yeah.
In fickleness.
Yeah.
Or in devotion to passion, as you say, and strong feeling. That's a risky posture to take in life, that you must feel strongly and intensely at all times.
Yeah.
I would think that would cause a person to run through many different relationships.
Yeah, which she did.
Yeah. Which she did. Now, if a man wrote this poem, would we receive it differently, do you think?
I don't think we would like it if a man wrote it.
Why do you suppose?
Because I think it speaks to a kind of heartlessness or a player attitude that we don't actually like in men.
Yeah, if a man wrote it, we would think, what a dick.
Right. Exactly. Right. And a woman, we're like, yeah, go girl.
Yeah. There's a double standard at work here. But nonetheless, she's somebody that went on to actually get married.
Yeah, she did. And I tend to think it's just because she couldn't keep burning so hot the way that she was living. Mm-hmm. And she had money problems. And I think it was exhausting. And she met Eugene and he was compelling and she felt safe with him. And he was a feminist and didn't want to cramp her style. And that really helped. That was the kind of man she could commit to.
And allowed her to have affairs and encouraged affairs and a very unconventional fellow.
Exactly.
In an unconventional marriage. Now, there's one more sonnet that you wanted to read that was written much later in life in the 1930s. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to read this one is to speak to her unconventional marriage and the fact that her longest, most important relationship was with George Dylan, who was for a time the editor of Poetry Magazine. And they had
editors of poetry, they're crazy.
So she had met him in the fall of 1928 while she was in Chicago on a promotional tour for her collection, The Buck in the Snow. And she was introduced to this young guy, George Dylan. He was only 22. Hmm. His first book of poems had just come out the year before, and he was an associate editor at Poetry Magazine. And so it would be 10 years later he would succeed Harriet Munro. Mm-hmm. Millay's biographer Nancy Mitford describes George Dylan as a modern Apollo, tall and slim with black wavy hair carefully brushed back from his face. Uh-huh. Is what she writes. And they became lovers immediately, and a lot of passionate letters go back and forth. There's one quoted in the biography that's Edna writing to George saying, "Darling, I don't know what kind of depressed, drunken, insane letter I wrote you, but I can well imagine because I haven't heard from you. I haven't heard from you at all." But it was a hugely productive relationship for both of them. She wrote a ton of sonnets in the year 1929 alone to both Eugene, her husband, and George Dylan. And so the one I'm reading right now, it's a collection of three sonnets, so I'll just read the first one.
Sure.
And it was published in Poetry Magazine in October of 1930. And it's more or less saying that if George were to ever leave her, she'd be perfectly fine for having been loved by him to begin with. Mm-hmm. "Women have loved before, as I love now, at least in lively chronicles of the past, of Irish waters by a Cornish prow, or Trojan waters by a Spartan mast, much to their cost invaded, here and there, hunting the amorous line, skimming the rest, I find some woman bearing as I bear love like a burning city in the breast. I think, however, that of all alive, I only in such utter ancient way do suffer love. In me alone survive the unregenerate passions of a day when treacherous queens, with death upon the tread, heedless and willful, took their knights to bed. And I love that for, I mean, she's just crazy for George Dylan. Yeah. And it's like, what's done is done. I'm going to do it. And it's killing me.
Hmm. There's that one line in there. She suffers love. What exactly does she say? I don't have it in front of me.
I think, however, that of all alive, I only in such utter ancient way do suffer love.
Mm.
I love, because that's how we all feel.
Yes.
When we're suffering love. Nobody has suffered the way I am suffering.
Yeah. So what's the difference in tone that you sense between that poem later in life than the ones we just heard earlier?
This poem, to me, there's a lot of vulnerability to it that we don't hear in her early poems, which are about her being indifferent and traipsing along. Yeah, cocky. And now she's saying, like, you've conquered my fortress.
Yeah. What does she say to women today that nobody else says? Or is her moment past? Did she have a cultural moment way back in the 20s and 30s and expressed a moment very well and created a moment in her poetry? Has that passed? Is there still something valid in her kind of her emotional landscape today?
There is. What I see valuable in her is in her commitment to passion, she was also being committed to high emotion. And I think that today, a lot of our talk about sexual freedom is about removing sex from emotion and trying to mimic a so-called male mentality where, you know, love them and leave them. And I mean, granted, that's what she was saying, love them and leave them, but she really loved when she loved. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just a physical thing or
there's nothing cool about her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And she was such a big deal in her time for being unconventional, but now she reads as there's something very naive and innocent about her.
Yeah.
And that's refreshing.
Kate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kate Bullock's piece on Edna St. Vincent Millay is up on our website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also read 19 of Millay's poems. Edna St. Vincent Millay will also feature into a book that Kate is writing that will come out in 2014. It will be called Among the Suitors on Being a Woman Alone. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.